Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening once again, and I'm County Supervisor Joe Simidian, and my office and I are very pleased to co-host tonight's program with the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Let me just begin by saying that, in my view, we are lucky to live in one of the most diverse places in the country, but without understanding the diverse cultures around us, misconceptions can and will abound. The goal this evening is simple. It is to create a better understanding of Islam among the general public, and our topic tonight is fear of a faith, Sharia, surveillance, terrorism, the Muslim ban, what's real and what's not. Let me begin by introducing tonight's panelists who have agreed to discuss these challenging issues. Amina Jandali, to my immediate right, is a founding member of the Islamic Networks Group and also teaches at San Francisco City College. She received her bachelor's degree in history from the University of Illinois and her master's degree in Near East Studies from UC Berkeley. Amina frequently delivers presentations on Islam and has appeared in many news outlets speaking on issues relating to American Muslims. Then, Jihad Turk is the president of the Bayan Claremont Islamic Graduate School. He received his undergraduate degree in history and Arabic from UC Berkeley and his master's degree in Arabic and Islamic law from the University of Texas. He also co-founded the Muslim Christian Consultative Group and the Greater Los Angeles Muslim Jewish Forum. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Amina Jandali and Jihad Turk. Thank you. As those of you who were with us the first time will know, this is a respectful conversation, but also one in which I will try and dig deep and make sure that we ask the questions that you would have asked had you been sitting in the chair. And then, of course, there will be time for your questions as well. Let's just jump right in with the phrase, radical Islamic terrorists. I am looking at comments from some folks who couldn't be here. One of them is President Donald Trump, who in his inauguration speech said, "We will unite the civilized world against radical Islamic terrorism, which we will eradicate completely from the face of the earth." The name that has been much in the news lately, of course, is that of General Michael Flynn. General Flynn was the director of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency under President Obama.
What happened to him?
No. Hold that thought, Jihad. And he was most recently the national security advisor for President Donald Trump. And he said in a speech just last year, "We are facing another ism, just like we face Nazism and fascism and imperialism and communism. This is Islamism. It is a vicious cancer inside the body of 1.7 billion people on this planet, and it has to be excised." And in a book that he co-wrote called The Field of Fight, he says, "It is no accident that radical Islamists in America are pushing very hard and very systematically to gain legal standing for Sharia and to forbid any and all criticism of Islam. These are all steps toward creating an Islamic state right here at home." Now, I want to focus on the use of the phrase radical Islamic terrorism. And I want to close by noting that there is a difference of opinion within the current administration. H.R. McMaster, President Trump's current national security advisor, has been quoted as sharing the notion with his staff that the label, quote, radical Islamic terrorism is not helpful because terrorists are un-Islamic. Quote, "Muslims who commit terrorist acts are perverting their religion," end quote. All right, with all of that as background, and thank you for your patience, radical Islamic terrorists or radical Islamic terrorism, is that a useful phrase or not? Is it a helpful phrase or not? Is it an accurate phrase or not? And let me just press a little right at the outset. If the Islamic State, as one example, has the word Islamic in its name, purports to carry out its violent acts in the name of Islam, and describes itself and its members as Muslims, why would it be incorrect to use the phrase radical Islamic terrorists? Who'd like to start?
Well, I'd just like to talk about our work at ING with the media around this issue, because when we started working with the media almost 24 years ago, that was one of the issues we brought up, the fact that when they say the word Islamic terrorist or Muslim fundamentalist, they are not using that same methodology when they talk about other groups. So you don't see the word Christian fundamentalist or Christian terrorist, for instance, when people are talking about the war in Bosnia or even talking about the IRA. So how is it appropriate to only use the religion when we're talking about Muslims if we're not going to do that across the board? Now, today, this aside, people hear the word terrorist and they automatically assume it's a Muslim. And in fact, one of the things that Muslims will often do when they hear about an act of violence, they will watch the news report. And if they hear the word terrorist, they know immediately it's a Muslim. If they hear the word lone wolf or mental or some of the other phrases, they know it's not a Muslim. So the word terrorist itself has become a loaded word that is used only for Muslims.
Jihad?
I tend to agree with McMaster on this one. And the reason why is because under the previous administration, there was a summit that was convened at the White House on countering violent extremism. And this is kind of the backdrop of why this is a contentious issue, is because it became politicized. Obama was accused of being soft on terrorism because he refused to use the expression radical Islamic terrorism. And so when he convened this summit, the summit focused, generally speaking, on the issue of violent extremism, whether it's white supremacist groups, other kinds of terrorist organizations, as well as those who claim to be Muslim and terrorists. And so in the run-up to that summit that I attended and was invited to participate in, there were a number of meetings that we had in Los Angeles with our delegation that went there, from law enforcement, from the various community leaders that participated. And we had the opportunity to meet with the senior representatives of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson himself, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and other intelligence communities, the White House administration and the State Department that focused on these events. And a lot of the law enforcement tend to be Republican in their orientation. So I asked them frankly, I said, what is your take? You're at the front lines, politically conservative, but you're here dealing with this issue in a real way, not in a political sense. What do you think is the best term to use? And they said, we agree, even though they were Republicans, we agree with the Obama administration's approach to this, because when you call them Islamic, you are endorsing them as a legitimate expression of Islam. Now, get to your second point as to, well, what about the fact that they call themselves Islamic State, et cetera? One of our faculty members at the graduate school that I serve at, he's African American. He converted to Islam some 30 years ago. And he taught for many years, he's at USC now, but he taught for many years in Michigan, University of Michigan. And after 9/11, when Al-Qaeda attacked the United States and the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, he was teaching a world religions course, co-teaching it with some other faculty. And here he is, a black man, before a class that was at least this large, if not larger. And he faced them in the aftermath of 9/11, and he wanted to put things in perspective as himself being, you know, a Muslim. And he said, imagine if an African American went to the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, and attacked it, bombed it or shot it up, at whatever. And that black person happened to be a Muslim. How many of you would think that that person who committed that criminal act would be inspired by his faith to do that, as opposed to race, right? So they all said, well, you know, it'd be race. Then he said, well, what if the person who committed, the same person committed that act, said that he did it because he was a Muslim? Only a few people raised their hands and said, well, he's, you know, agreeing that he did it because he was a Muslim. But most people said, well, still, race is the issue. And the fundamental point that I would make, and I was on a panel, an NPR program with Adam Schiff, who's the senior intelligence committee member, ranking intelligence committee member of the House of Representatives, representing a district in Southern California, on this issue, and the head of RAND's Corporation Counterterrorism Unit a couple of years ago. And we were asking the same question, like, well, is it Islamic? Is it Islamic? And basically, we were all in agreement that what's really going on, and even though media doesn't do a good job of covering it, what's really going on in places in which there is political, there is ideologically motivated violence, it takes places in countries in which there is a military conflict struggling for political power. And sometimes regional countries are playing a role to up the ante in terms of arming the different parties. Part of what's going on is competing nationalist narratives and identity politics in which religion plays a role of a sort of a tribal or nationalist or ultra-nationalist narrative. Now, in places like France, where they just had the election, you have ultranationalism, and religion really wasn't exactly part of Le Pen's movement. But you have other countries in which it is a part. Northern Ireland, for example, you had the Catholics against the Protestants. It wasn't the Catholics. There wasn't anything in Catholicism that led the IRA to commit acts of terrorism. They were trying to secure political power. The same thing in Iraq. Who are the three groups? And we just now decided we're going to support, as a country, the Kurds. The three groups fighting in Iraq, and I'll stop here because I'm going a little bit long, but the three groups fighting in Iraq are the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds. Well, the Sunnis are Sunni Muslim. The Shiites are Shiite Muslim. What religion are the Kurds? Well, sometimes people might say, well, they're Christian. No. Some people might say Muslim. Okay, well, what kind of Muslim? Sunni or Shiite? And the reality is, and you probably, many of you might not have thought about it, the reality is they're Sunni Muslim. Who are they fighting? The Sunni Muslims. So it's really not about Sunni Islam. It's about nationalist identities competing for territorial control in the region of Iraq, but, plus Iran and Saudi Arabia and Turkey and the United States and Russia.
Let me go back, though, to the push point on this, which is folks who have a different point of view would say again, if people call themselves Muslim, if the word Islam is in the name of their organization, and if when there is an attack, the attack is made, quote, in the name of Islam, why then is it inaccurate, if it is, to use the phrase radical Islamic terrorist?
Well, I would go back to the KKK example, because what is the symbol of the KKK? What is it they plant on the lawn of the person whose house they're attacking? But would most Christians call them a Christian group? So just because they call themselves Christian doesn't mean that they represent Christianity. And certainly the world would be a terrible place if every time people did something in the name of a particular religion, everyone would agree to that. Slavery itself, if we look at the history of slavery, you had proponents of slavery quoting the Bible and you had abolitionists quoting the Bible. Who were the true Christians?
And yet, again, folks who are pressing this point are making the argument that there are supporting tenets of Islam for this violent action. So not that I'm recommending it as a source, but if I were to go to the Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam, which I know our panelists here are familiar with, which purports to be a New York Times bestseller, Chapter 2, The Quran, Book of War, and I'm quoting, "The Quran is unique among the sacred writings of the world in counseling its adherents to make war against unbelievers." Goes on to say, PC myth, the Quran teaches tolerance and peace. And if I jump ahead to chapter 3, Islam, religion of war. Guess what? And again, I'm quoting, "Muhammad taught his followers that there was nothing better or holier than jihad warfare. Muhammad told his men to offer non-Muslims only three choices, conversion, subjugation, or death. And these teachings are not marginal doctrines or historical relics. They are still taught in mainstream Islam." I'm guessing you have a different point of view.
Well, first of all, my name is Jihad, so I don't have any objection to Jihad, which is a beautiful thing. And as I said in my last presentation, my father gave me the name Jihad and told me it was the meaning of it was the struggle to do the right thing. And it was always something I tried to live up to. Jihad doesn't mean fighting and killing people. It means the struggle to do the right thing. And usually that's takes place through social engagement, charity, also inner reform and character building. And on occasion, it could also include just war. Like in Catholicism, we have a just war theory. There are times in which, even as a nation, we justify military action. Not that we are bloodthirsty as a nation, but there are times in which we need to defend our borders. And so I'm not suggesting Islam is a pacifist religion. In fact, I'm going to scare you a little bit before I unscare you and actually quote from chapter 2 of the Quran. I took out my iQuran app. I'm not searching through my emails. And I'm going to quote you probably one of the most oft-cited verses in certain certain blogs that have talking points against Islam. And it's a verse that says, this is chapter 2, verse 191, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ, which is the Arabic, the original Arabic. And in translation it reads, kill them where you find them. It literally says that, kill them where you find them. And when you hear that verse, you know, it's scary, right? Because you're assuming that the them, first of all, are Christians and Jews, which it's not. And you think that that's kind of the mandate. However, to read the entire context, what this verse is saying is speaking to Muhammad and his companions at 1,400 years ago in Arabia regarding the tribe that it declared open warfare against them. And tried to limit the practice of their faith. They were kind of a marginalized community and an oppressed community, if you will. And so they were under siege by this oppressive sort of tribe, very powerful tribe in the Arabian desert. And they had declared open war on the Muslims. And so the prophet, for 13 years of his life, practiced nonviolence. Some of his followers were tortured and killed and mistreated. And this verse came and it said, okay, when you encounter the enemy, you can fight them. However, to read the larger context, if your enemy is inclined towards peace, make peace. Nowhere in the Quran does it say to kill Christians and Jews. It's not in the Quran. The mandate here puts peace as the principle and conflict, military conflict, as the exception. Now, kill them where you find them is not a commandment for terrorism either. This had to do with a tactical instruction that when you encounter an enemy on the battlefield, don't turn and run, you fight them where you encounter them. But if you read the 1,400 years of Islamic law or Sharia regarding issues of law of warfare, the jurisprudence surrounding the issue of warfare, it also says that you cannot kill a non-combatant, you cannot kill a woman or a child or an elderly person, you can only engage in battle according to the rules of engagement with people who are engaging you on the battlefield. And so all of this idea of terrorism, which is a modern phenomenon that predates Islam's involvement in terrorism, you could look to many different conflicts around the world in which terrorism is invoked as a tactic, is not an Islamic idea and is, in fact, an affront to Islam. So with regards to radical Islamic terrorism, I would say yes. We are in a battle for the hearts and minds. And people who are trying to invoke Islam to justify these acts, it's an affront to me as a believing Muslim. It's very offensive and upsetting. And some of you might say, well, how come we haven't heard you say it? Well, we've been shouting it from the tops of our lungs and every opportunity we have. And we appreciate the opportunity here. And we appreciate your attendance and your interest in hearing us. But we haven't been able to break through, because when you have a graphic video that ISIS produces in which they're cutting off someone's head, that gets play on the 24-hour news cycle ad nauseum, where someone's saying, no, we condemn that, that doesn't get airtime.
Amina, anything else on this
subject?
Yeah,
well, my father hails from India, which was ruled by the Mughals and other Muslim rulers for some 8 centuries, And yet Muslims today are 13% of the population. Now, given that there was a partition, so the Muslims went to Pakistan. So we could up it to maybe 40-50%. But if indeed what Robert Spencer said is correct, how did all those Hindus survive? How were they able to still be Muslim? If you look at some of the areas in the Middle East, and I actually lived in Jordan when I was in high school, and there's literally a church next to every mosque across the city that I lived in, Amman. The church, the most holy church in Palestine, is actually, you probably know Sayyid Nusayba. It's held by two Palestinian families. One of them is the Nusayba family because the Christian families were fighting over who gets to open it. And they have that honor to open it every morning and close it. In Lebanon, the population is 30%. In Bosnia, we heard about the Bosnian War. Well, how did the Serbs and the Croats survive? So geographically, historically, it's actually not correct. If you do look at Europe, however, you don't find a lot of Muslims left because, as we know in Spain, Muslims and Jews were actually given a choice to either convert or leave, and many of the Jews left to Muslim countries where they lived in comparative peace. Obviously, anything like a modern citizen and the rights that they have was not available. Me and Jihad, in addition to being Cal Bears, yes, I know the last two, you had some Stanford.
You're across the street from Stanford University. I'd watch your geography.
Here,
there you go.
We both have mothers who are Christian, actually, and that's another thing. If indeed you are commanded to kill the disbelievers, how do you marry a Christian woman, which is allowed, and actually a Muslim man is required to treat his Muslim, his non-Muslim Jewish or Christian wife with total respect, taking her to church, allowing her to worship as she chooses. He cannot force his religion upon her. So the idea of Ahl al-Kitab is actually something quite unique in the Quran. There's two actions that kind of derive from the concept of Ahl al-Kitab, which is people of the book, generally defined as Muslims, Jews, and Christians based on Quranic verses, that you can also eat the food, which is generally assumed to be the meat of the people of the book. So it's actually a jurisprudence point that there's two valid types of meat that Muslims can eat. One is halal, which is like kosher. The other is meat that was prepared or butchered by a Christian or a Jew. So that is actually something quite unique among religions, and he obviously doesn't acknowledge that.
So if we were to put aside for a moment the issue of violence and terrorism and move then to what some folks refer to as political Islam. And as both our panelists know, there are folks who make the case that Islam is as much a political system as it is a religious set of beliefs. One of the names that I know is, again, common to our two panelists, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is the author of Heretic and, I believe, Infidel before that, a best-selling author, was recently interviewed just last month in the Wall Street Journal. And I'm going to quote from the article, says, America needs to be on full alert against political Islam because, quote, its program is fundamentally incompatible with the U.S. Constitution, end quote. And then the article goes on to say, fundamentally incompatible with religious pluralism, the equality of men and women, and other fundamental rights, including the toleration of different sexual orientations. Islam, the religion, in Ms. Hirsi Ali's view, is a Trojan horse that conceals Islamism, the political movement. And in her most recent book, Heretic, she says, it is foolish to insist, as our leaders habitually do, that the violent acts of radical Islamists can be divorced from the religious ideals that inspire them. Instead, we must acknowledge that they are driven by a political ideology, an ideology embedded in Islam itself, in the holy book of the Quran, as well as the life and teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. Let me make my point in the simplest of terms. Islam is not a religion of peace. So we're talking about now Islamism as a political movement, Islamism as perhaps made manifest by groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who are active politically in, I think, close to a dozen nations around the world in terms of their representation in political bodies or governmental bodies in those countries. The question then is, what about political Islam? Is that real? Is it something that we should be concerned about, fearful of? Your take.
So I just want to address the issue of, you know, Islam versus Islamism first. I mean, the whole notion that Islam is a thing is obviously, like any religion. You have 1.6 billion people, you have 14 centuries of practice, and you can't really summarize that and say it's this way or that way. The first leader of the new Muslim community in Jihad talked about the wars or the battles that took place, because basically when Muhammad began preaching monotheism, and you know the main focus of Islam was on monotheism, he was rejected by the majority of the people in Mecca, the Quraysh. And for 13 years, as Jihad mentioned, the people were persecuted but didn't really fight back. And then only after they moved to Medina, where they were invited to now openly practice their religion, did this warfare take place for the next 10 years. Eventually, Muhammad was able to go back into Mecca in a bloodless coup, and Islam began to spread throughout the Arabian Peninsula and onward. And so in the life of the Prophet Muhammad, yes, indeed, he was both the religious leader as well as the theological and political leader. Can't really make a comparison, maybe King Henry, but I don't think that's a great comparison. After he died, there followed what are known as the four righteous caliphs, who were known for their piety, for their early acceptance of Islam. And after them, it reverted to the Umayyads, Abbasids, and eventually the Ottomans. I would say that the idea that there was no division between politics and religion is actually not true, because you had, during different times and these different dynasties, all-out conflict between scholars such as Ibn Hanbal, who was actually imprisoned by one of the Abbasid caliphs. You know, the Umayyads and the Abbasids were generally, as most rulers are, concerned with warfare, building palaces, dancing girls. They weren't terribly pious people. And it was really the scholars who upheld the religion and often reminded the rulers that they weren't doing a very good job. And for that, they paid a heavy price. So this whole notion that there's always been this meeting of politics and religion is actually not upheld by history. They were called the caliphs, but did that mean the same thing as the first righteously guided caliphs? Most people would say that is not the case. So the very notion of an Islamic state, I would say, is not based in history. Are there groups today that are trying to revise this ideal? There are, and most of them look at those first four caliphs, but there's a spectrum. And I don't, again, to talk about Islamic State, which, by the way, most Arabs disdainfully call them Daesh because they don't want to acknowledge them as being Islamic. You know, it's almost a joke that you can come out and claim to be a caliphate. You know, you can't just stand up and say, I'm the caliph. Anyone who seeks power, first of all, is exempt from power. It's a responsibility not to be sought after. Nobody took this seriously. I mean, the guy has, I haven't heard from him for a couple of years, so I don't even know if he's still alive. But the very concept of Islamic State itself is very much in flux. So what Taliban consider an Islamic State might be very different from Saudi Arabia, which is a monarchy, which goes against the whole concept of shura, which is, you know, mutual consensus. Are they an Islamic State? Is Iran an Islamic State? Just because you call yourself an Islamic State does not mean you're an Islamic State. Well, so,
and let's go back to the Muslim Brotherhood,
yeah,
who, as I say, is you know, active in probably a dozen countries or more around the world. Excuse me, and who I believe have parliamentarians in at least 10 nations across the globe. What's the intersection between politics and religion in the places where the Muslim Brotherhood is active? And is any of that relevant to what's going on here in the United States?
So I can maybe tackle that one. Think of the Muslim Brotherhood in this way. In the United States, we have the Christian Coalition, right? Do they have a different form of government? Well, I mean, they probably would like to abolish the Johnson Amendment or to, have the state maybe be more involved in supporting a religious denomination or Christianity in particular. You know, they might blur the lines and go against the grain on a number of things, but fundamentally they're still part of a democracy. They're advocating for elections and more of their leadership to be in elected office, but it's not like they have a different form of government. Similarly, you mentioned that there are a number of people who are elected members of parliament in a dozen Muslim nations that identify as part of this Muslim Brotherhood. It's kind of like the Christian coalition of the Muslim world, in which case they're participating in those states that have a participatory government. And maybe they have different values or they have a different posture with regards to the understanding of Islam and the way that governance should engage with religion, but it's not a different form of government.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Olivier Roy, who is a very famous French expert on this issue, unlike Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's quite frankly a hate monger and is not an expert in this field, Olivier Roy wrote a book called The Failure of Political Islam back in the 1990s and was responding to the call from the Muslim Brotherhood in places like Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began, and said, Muslims are just advocating for reform because their governments were corrupt, but they don't really have, other than rhetoric, they don't really have an alternative form of government. Full circle now, Arab Spring began in Tunisia. The main person who was leading the Islamist movement, Rashid al-Ghannouchi, last year acknowledged that there is no Islamic form of government, renounced Islamism, and said, we are now going to simply be a political party as part of the, you know, of the network of political parties or the spectrum of political parties that exist in Tunisia, and has foregone this claim that they're somehow an Islamist political party. And so really they're advocating the values of religion, which is justice and fairness and prosperity and things like that. So yeah, I would say that the call of the Brotherhood in many of the places is really a reaction to, a response to oppressive regimes, oppressive governments, rigged elections and other things, and they are invoking religion as somehow a uniting call to get people to somehow push back against this injustice.
Amina?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it depends on what country we're talking about. I mean, so Erdogan, for instance, who has been criticized for his increasingly dictatorial attitudes, but, you know, when he first started, he was, you know, doing a pretty decent job, his wife.
And Erdogan is?
Oh, he's the now president of Turkey, previously prime minister. And, yeah, it's looking a little scary, the route he's taking, so I'm not defending him. I'm just saying that, you know, surprising to many people, he was able to govern what was formerly quite secular country, despite the fact that his wife wore the headscarf. I mean, he didn't go in there and turn it into a Taliban-type state. I do have Egyptian friends who, you know, were very happy when Morsi was overthrown because they were worried about the Taliban. So I guess the issue is not so much political Islam, quote-unquote, it's what kind. There's a spectrum of interpretation, a spectrum of practice, and even among those who believe that there is a place in politics for religion, they're not all the Taliban, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, let's make the transition then. We've talked about violence and terrorism, and we've talked about political systems. And Jihad, you made the observation that there really isn't an Islamic political system, but I'm guessing that some in the auditorium are saying, well, what about Sharia law? And I'm guessing many here have had occasion to read over the last decade, you know, at this point, well over half of the states in the country have had legislation introduced was an effort or an attempt to prohibit the use of Sharia law in state courts. And while I think many folks would say, well, you know, is that a real issue? Is that a threat? What's that about? You know, proponents come back and say, well, in fact, in state courts, particularly in divorce or custody matters, people invoke their religious beliefs, including Sharia, in certain commercial transactions, again, that take place in a situation where they're governed in theory by state law, but folks who end up in court may then argue that Sharia should guide the outcome or the disposition of a dispute on a commercial transaction. Doesn't that mean that there is some legitimate basis for concern about a creep towards the use of Sharia law, provisions of Sharia law, in what is otherwise a secular judiciary. That's the argument that people make.
All right.
Amina, who would like to start on this one?
I can take this one. So I studied Sharia for my graduate degree. It was, you know, Islamic jurisprudence, fiqh, or Sharia. I mean, that's what I did my master's degree, and I did 8 years towards my PhD at UCLA. Still not finished. This is my sort of my field of expertise. What's happening in Oklahoma, for example, where they did pass a constitutional amendment to prohibit Sharia, which, by the way, was overturned by the Supreme Court of the United States, what was the reason why it was introduced wasn't because of legitimate concerns about Sharia being invoked in divorce courts or transaction courts. It was because a politician, strategist, political strategist, decided that there was such fear and anxiety about the actions of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the mistreatment of women, which they do, and the brutal kinds of punishments that they exact there, stoning and other things. There was so much fear and concern about Islam and terrorism and Sharia in general that a strategist sat down one election cycle and said, listen, we can scare people to the polls to vote for our candidates if we also include an amendment that is, you know, has these wedge issues. Anti-immigrant, that is, that is anti-LGBTQ, and that is anti-Sharia. And we can get people to vote for our ticket down the line. It has nothing to do with the actual substance of these. Consider for a moment the Jewish community court here in California. They actually have a system of arbitrators who adjudicate for the Jewish community Jewish divorce. It's called a get. And there's a big problem in the Jewish community, how to get a get. Because if there's a civil divorce, but the man doesn't issue a divorce to his wife, she cannot remarry, according to Jewish law. And so they have these systems in place to arbitrate and then to intervene on occasion on behalf of the woman to get her a divorce. Now, you know, if a community does that outside the jurisdiction of the court, then that's, you know, that which is practiced here in the Jewish community, that's fine. Now, what if there was a prenup in which the settlement would be in accordance with Jewish law or Islamic law or whatever to determine who gets what by way of the finances of the household? If that was a prenup and it was agreed upon by the parties and the court is simply implementing that, there's nothing fearful that it's going to somehow impose itself on the rest of society at large. This is a private contract between two individuals, and the court is simply enforcing it. So there's not really a there. It's more fear-mongering, identity politics, wedge issues, election cycles, and the people are preying on ignorance and fear that exists in society.
Amina?
Well, when I got here, I actually practiced some Sharia because, if you remember, I went to the bathroom, I washed up, and then I told you I was going to go perform my afternoon prayer. So that would be, you know, practicing Sharia. You can't really be an adherent Muslim without practicing some Sharia. So Sharia is not a set of laws. It's an understanding that is believed to be derived from the Quran, which is considered to be the holy text, the revealed text from God, and the Hadith, which refers to the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And then those become the basis for laws of how to pray, how to fast. Ramadan's coming up. You know, how do we know what to do in Ramadan? What doesn't specifically say in the Quran? Well, we look at the Hadith, and scholars have determined it. It means, you know, fasting from before the sun rises until the sun sets. And what do you do if you're not able to fast? So all of this is based on rules that were developed over the centuries, taken from those two sources. Sometimes there is no clear ruling, and there's something in Islam called ijtihad, which means independent reasoning, which, you know, I do it on a daily basis because even if I walked around with the Quran in one hand and, well, the Hadith, there's, you know, multiple volumes, I wouldn't find the answer to everything in the Quran. I mean, the whole issue of can women drive? There is no verse in the Quran that says thou shalt not drive, you know, right? So what do the scholars say? Well, first of all, there's a principle in Islam that if there's not a specific prohibition, then it's allowed. But that's not enough for some people. So you could actually make the analogy that the Prophet Muhammad invited a woman to ride on the back of his camel, which would be comparable to, you know, a car today. And yet the Saudis uphold this I don't know if they think they're citing Islamic law. I think it's more of a custom, because in the rest of the majority Muslim countries, women are allowed to drive, although it's sometimes quite risky because the way people drive is crazy, which is a different story. So at the end of the day, I think the word Sharia is, as Jihad said, kind of a scare word. And there were similar times in our history when it was predicted that the Pope was going to take over the White House, and that if people practiced magisterium or if people practiced halakha law, we would lose, you know, our Constitution. Well, we need to have more faith in our Constitution that it can ride out these, you know, threats. And Muslims are 1-2% of the population. To believe that they could actually implement Sharia in America, which is giving them a little too much power.
Well, of course, the folks who have been making this case in, as I say, more than half the states in the country, have done it in a variety of ways. Some have specifically called out Sharia, and quite purposefully, quite deliberately. Others, of course, have made the case that they are introducing legislation which is neutral on its face, that does not mention right. any specific
More recently,
religion,
yeah.
And that it is simply an effort to underscore that no religious law or foreign law, right. contrary to the Constitution of the United States, shall be considered in a state court setting. Why should that be disconcerting? Because it clearly...
First of all, the campaigning around it is the disconcerting part. That, in its face value, is nothing wrong with it, but it's redundant. I mean, you don't need a law to say that anything contradicts the Constitution is shouldn't be considered. If it contradicts the Constitution, it shouldn't be considered already. You don't need a law to say that. Let's not mistake what's really going on here. This is identity politics, fear-mongering, wedge issues, scaring people to the polls, and preying on people's fear and ignorance. So, you know, if they become more subtle in the language, it's only so that they could pass the legal challenges, which they failed on many occasions. But the campaigning around it is no less vitriolic and bigoted. And so, you know, and if you look at more than half the states, what states are we talking about? We're not talking about Democratic majority states. So, you know, this is a political wedge issue.
And actually, a lot of the states, there's not a lot of Muslims there to even worry about.
Less than 1% of the population. So it's not a real threat.
Well, those particular states have even less Muslims. Yeah. I mean, if we're talking about Fremont, okay, maybe, you know. But we're talking about Mississippi. I mean, some of the states where you really do not have a large population.
So for the last 30 minutes, I have made a point of poking you. And asking you some questions as a devil's advocate, perhaps.
You were trying to see an angry Muslim up here, weren't you?
Well, you actually anticipate my question to some extent, Jihad, because the question I want to ask is, how does it feel to have to answer these questions? No one asked me these questions.
Well,
no one asked most of the folks who are in the auditorium today these questions. So how does it feel to have folks asking these questions and to make you feel like you're in some way obligated to answer them?
So I'll tell you my personal experience. So I'm an American kid from Arizona who grew up with an exotic name that people did not associate with Islam back in the 70s when I was born and raised. And it wasn't until after 9/11, I was already in graduate school at UCLA doing my doctoral work, that people started in the general popular consciousness of America making the association with jihad and whatnot. I don't look too Muslimy. I, as I said last time, I try and kept a little bit of a stubble to make me look more Middle Eastern. My mom's, you know, Caucasian American from Oklahoma. My dad is from Jerusalem. He's from the Holy Land. He's Palestinian. But I have to say that I don't face personal discrimination. Maybe because I'm approachable culturally, I'm American. I don't have an accent. And so when people say, "Oh wait, jihad, doesn't that mean holy war?" It's a sincere question. I don't face bigotry, animosity, hatred. And so for me, I feel more reaffirmed in my American Muslim identity and the American spirit or the Christian spirit, the patriotism that I feel is in some ways, you know, I'm reaffirmed in that by the openness that my fellow American has, and I appreciate the question. Because there's an interest in learning, and that's why I'm encouraged by such a large attendance here tonight, because there's an openness to wanting to understand, because it is scary what you see on the news. If I wasn't Muslim and I saw what I see on the news without having the greater context, I would be scared of Islam and Muslims. So, you know, it's very reasonable and understandable, but that openness that I'm approached with by my fellow citizens is, to me, it's heartwarming. It's not frustrating. I hear some young people, you know, who just want to fit in. Oh, this is, why do I have the burden of having to explain all the time, et cetera? And maybe Amina can speak to this, who wears a headscarf and is identifiably Muslim. She might have a different experience that I'm interested to hear about. But for me personally, you know, I take on the challenge with enthusiasm and am encouraged by the receptivity that I have.
Amina?
It can be tiring. I mean, I do this on an ongoing basis. You don't really realize it until you're in a situation where you're talking with other religions on an equal footing, and everyone gets asked the same question, and everyone has to answer it. So when you're the only one in the hot seat, sometimes it's challenging. And sometimes the people of other religions get to kind of answer the easy questions, like, how do you pray? And that sometimes seems unfair. But I, like Jihad said, I understand it. I mean, the polls show that 60-80% of the news stories about Muslims have to do with violence. You know, every time a Muslim does something, you're going to see tenfold if someone else who wasn't a Muslim did it. And if that's all you're seeing, that's all you're hearing, you don't know a Muslim personally, you haven't read a book about Islam, you know, I can't really blame people. So, you know, I think it's important that Muslims are up here representing themselves because we don't always get to be on television, although I know Jihad has.
Joe, if I could, the topic at hand, to me, is such an important topic that I, when I was doing my graduate work in a very arcane, you know, medieval, you know, history and theology and philosophy, et cetera, of Islam, I took a lot of courses trying to answer for myself what went wrong. Like, why are so many Muslims involved in violence around the world, and why is that such a headline? And you know, after years of trying to wrap my head around it, I finally came up with, I think, a very reasonable explanation and understanding that allows me to look at all of those actions and other acts of political violence around the world with one united lens. But we don't have enough time for me to explain what that is, so that's okay. No, I'm just kidding. So I'll say it in a nutshell, because I know that there are a lot of questions to get to. The conclusion that I came to is that what we have here is not really religion, and the Islamic religion in particular, manifesting itself in a violent way. What we really have here, if you look at all the places in which there is violence in the name of religion or violence in general in political conflicts, you will find that what you have is a competing nationalist narratives within the borders of a nation state. I'll say that again. In all of the places in which there is bloody conflict, oftentimes religion is invoked as part of that, not all the time. They're in places in which there are competing nationalist identities within the borders of a nation state. So outside the Muslim context, I already invoked Northern Ireland, and you all know what was going on there. There's two different Christian groups, and one of them invoked terrorism or utilized terrorism regularly towards that political end. But let's take the most, you know, just to give you a sense of how any religion can be instrumentalized towards ultra-nationalist narrative, let's take the example of what most people would think is the most peaceful religion on earth, which is
Buddhism.
Thank you. Myanmar, Burma, President Obama went there, and he called them out on the mistreatment, and I'm being gentle here, of the Rohingya Muslim community. Now, 2% of Myanmar or Burma are Muslim, and it's a majority Buddhist country. Now, they were a military dictatorship until recently. The Nobel laureate there was one of the champions that helped transition the country to democracy. Well, what happened? We hosted at our university a State Department sponsored trip of Buddhist monks from the area in which Buddhist monks were from their temples, encouraging their community to go out and hack up the Muslim minority population. And the monk who was from that region, obviously not one of the extremist monks, he came and he says, teach us how we can get along in peace like you do here in the United States. I said, you guys are Buddhists. Why are you coming to me for that? He said, well, you don't understand. The military intelligence community infiltrated our monasteries and are invoking Buddhism to rally the community to, in our new democracy to promote an ultra-nationalist narrative. They're invoking Buddhists to encourage people to go out and commit acts of murder and mayhem against the minority community. Buddhism. There's nothing inherent in Buddhism that leads to that. It's ultra-nationalist narrative in this transitionary political environment. So if you can do that with Buddhism, you can do it with Islam, and that's what we are arguing is happening really with Islam. It's not really Islam itself. It's the way people are invoking it for other political ends.
So I've asked you both how you feel about having to answer these questions or being asked these questions. Let me take it a step farther. Within the last few months in the news, there's been a new settlement in New York City with the New York Police Department around surveillance issues there. As you know, there has been a long, contentious relationship between the police department and the Muslim community in New York, as well as other groups, around issues of surveillance, Muslim mapping, as it is sometimes called, the use of infiltrators. What's your take on that? That folks who are concerned about radical Islamic terrorism would say, well, if that's the source of the terrorism, those are the folks we should be watching. And obviously, in the New York setting, the Muslim community pushed back and has achieved a settlement now with the New York Police Department, putting some greater set of limits or boundaries around police department activities. But your take, your experience, if any, with these issues, Amina?
I know they have a lot of experience in L.A., but it just doesn't work. There's no proof that it works at all. What it does is it alienates the community. It makes them fearful. It makes them distrust law enforcement, which is absolutely the worst thing to happen. I mean, if you have people, and we know that the immigrant community in general now are not as eager to call the police in case of a crime, in case of domestic violence, it is those police departments where they've gone in and reached out to the Muslim community and other communities and got to know them and broke bread with them, that they're going to have a lot more success. And in a lot of these cases where they actually were able to apprehend terrorists, it was Muslim community members who came forward because they had that trust. They didn't worry that if they were going to turn over somebody, they themselves might end up being arrested. So I think it is not shown to work, and it makes people very paranoid.
Yeah,
and briefly, I want to get to the audience.
I agree with Amina, and I'll stop there.
All right. I want to go to your questions, and thank you. We have a lot of them. I think the first two or three questions I would summarize this way. How can we be assured that you two are representative and not just moderate Muslims who are here, but unrepresentative of the larger Muslim community, either in the United States or across the globe?
I represent all Islam. No, I'm just kidding. Well, there was a book actually written and researched in the days after 9/11. As the story goes, Dick Cheney, remember those days, W? Dick Cheney, after 9/11, convened a meeting of some thought leaders in the White House, and they were... Amongst the questions that were asked was, what does the Muslim world think of 9/11 and the terrorist attacks there? And someone said, we don't know. It's not like we have a Gallup poll of the population there. Well, the head of Gallup was one of the people around the table. And so he said, all right, let's embark on a study. Gallup did a six-year study of the entire 1.7 billion Muslim population in the world. And over that 6 years... statistically representing the entire community, ask questions about what Muslims think about democracy, about freedom, women's rights, human rights, all of these kinds of things. And that book was published. And it's entitled, Who Speaks for Islam? What 1 billion Muslims actually think, or really think. And it was published by a Georgetown University professor, John Esposito, and Dalia Mugahed.
And the answer is?
You have to read it and find out. No, the answer is what you find in that book is reflected in what Amina and I are saying here on stage. Muslims want for their kids what you want for your kids. They like democracy as much as you like democracy as a form of government. They love human rights. They are more opposed to terrorism than your average American, according to that study. So it might be surprising. More Americans support terrorism than Muslims do, percentage-wise. So read the study. Gallup did it. So it's not a fly-by-night kind of an institution.
All right. Next question, because yeah. I want to make sure we get time for audience questions. Amina, there are a number of questions that go to an issue that Jihad addressed earlier, so I want to address this to you, which is, why don't folks in the Muslim community speak out against violence and terrorism when it occurs? And this is an issue that Jihad already responded to, so I'm going to go to you and get your take on that.
Well, that's a question I get a lot, and it's absolutely not true. And in fact, there is a young girl, I don't know if you read the article, I can't remember her name, and she got so tired of hearing
Colorado.
What is it?
She was in Colorado.
She was at UC Boulder. I was actually born in Boulder myself. So if you just Google young girl and terrorism, she found almost 6,000 condemnations of terrorism against terrorism, and she made it into a website. The website that I'm more familiar with is called The American Muslim. And this is Sheila Musaji, who has been collecting condemnations. And if you go there, there's a whole section on there. So it's absolutely not the case. With regard to ISIS, there was a letter written by 100 scholars to the so-called Caliph Baghdadi, calling him out specifically for the atrocities that they're committing. And that has been signed by, I believe, 300 scholars now to date. And in India, you had a meeting of 10,000 people to condemn ISIS. So unfortunately, as we know with the media, if it bleeds, it leads. You could have a peaceful protest, and the media will not show up. As soon as someone hits the other person, you'll have the media there in a heartbeat. It's not as interesting.
Speaking of peaceful protest, the question is, why hasn't there been a million Muslim march against terrorism?
I think Muslims might be a little worried to come out by themselves to do that, and I think it would be good maybe to have it with all groups working for peace. Some people might say that the Women's March was really that, so maybe it takes a woman to do that.
There are a number of questions about who speaks for Islam, and I think we've addressed that question. There are at least two or three questions about whether or not Islam condones the stoning of women and under what circumstance.
Yeah, so you know that verse in the Quran about stoning women, right? You guys have all read that, right? Raise your hand. All right. It's actually not in the Quran. It's in the Bible. I'm not joking. So the issue is, you know, does Islamic law mandate the stoning of women? And historically, it was technically part of the law, although it was almost never carried out. And the modern scholars, people like Tariq Ramadan, who is a leading Muslim intellect, who's based out of Qatar and also teaches at Oxford, he's a European Muslim, he's advocating for something called the suspension of these kinds of legal punishments, like stoning or other kinds of medieval practices of punishment. So they exist in the books, but they're not a real part of Islamic mainstream practice anywhere in the world today, other than in places that are run by groups like ISIS or the Taliban, which are not reflective of the majority Muslim position on the issue.
Amina, on this point, and also we have some questions about honor killings of family members.
Well, I just want to expand a little bit.
Please.
On adultery. You know, even if you were, it is not in the Quran, the stoning. It's related in some prophetic sayings, but the actual punishment that is laid out in the Quran is 100 lashes. However, first of all, it's for men and women. They're treated equally. Second of all, you have to have 4 eyewitnesses to the act. And anyone who claims that they witnessed it without having those 4 witnesses, they themselves are subject to punishment. So it's quite serious to bring forth that claim. And there are no accounts of that happening in the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad except if people confess themselves. So I'm highly doubtful, highly suspicious that in places like Saudi Arabia or under the Taliban, if they're actually following the protocols, which is why I think Tariq Ramadan called for the moratorium. In terms of honor killings, there's actually, as I said, the verse in the Quran that says if you even speak ill of a woman, you yourself are subject to punishment. So that would do away with honor killings because they're not only speaking ill, but they're carrying out murder, which is the most serious crime that you can commit against any person. God made life sacred, so suicide is forbidden, taking a person's life is forbidden, and vigilantism is also something that is not part of the Islamic ethos. That would be something that would be presented in a court of law, and they would have to come to a decision. You wouldn't take the law into your own hands because that would be considered murder. So honor killings are more of a cultural practice. They exist in many Muslim-majority countries and also in some countries that are not Muslim, for marrying outside your caste or marrying outside your tribe. They also exist in parts of South Asia as well as some Christian Arabs.
And it's an affront to Islam, and it's practiced even in places like South America and other non-Muslim countries. So it's cultural and tribal, not Islamic.
I want to squeeze in one last pair of audience questions, and then I have a final question for you. And the audience questions go to the issue of non-believers. How should they be treated? And does the Quran call for war against Jews and Christians? So for the non-Muslims in the audience, and I suspect that's a significant majority, how does Islam apply to the view of the Muslims and the behavior of Muslims?
So I'm gonna say something that might be a little bit surprising to people here. The Quran not only gives protection or grants protection to Christians and Jews and others, but even though the Islam and the Quran has exclusive truth claims, God is only one, and you know the values are pretty much shared with Christianity and Judaism, but God is only one, there's a day of judgment, heaven and hell. Nonetheless, in chapter 2, verse 62, if you want to look it up, the Quran says that Christians, Jews, and others have the possibility of even attaining salvation. You know, heaven is not exclusive to Muslims, according to the scripture of the Quran. So if heaven is even a pathway that is open to Christians and Jews, in the hereafter, right, then here in this world, we are mandated, according to the Quran, to treat each other with mutual dignity and respect. And then you also asked one other...
apostasy.
Go ahead.
So, to add to that, I'd already mentioned about Christians and Jews being specifically referred to in the Quran as people of the book, that you can marry a woman of the person of the book. So how could you be mandated to kill your wife? I mean, that wouldn't make sense, especially if you had a big wedding. And like I said, I mean, you just... if you travel in Muslim-majority countries, you will see churches, you will see synagogues, you will see temples. How does that... I mean, how can you deny geography? These percentages who have... how do they survive? How do the Lebanese Christians survive? If you look at Arab Americans in this country, people like Ralph Nader, Donna Shalala, you know, those are Lebanese Christians. A lot of them came here at the turn of the century, but they survived for 14 centuries. In terms of apostasy...
Ralph Nader is not that old. No, I'm just kidding.
Apostasy, there are Muslim-majority countries who have apostasy laws on their books, which are, you know, reprehensible, and there's been work to try to change that. And there is a verse in the Quran that talks about somebody who accepts Islam and then leaves Islam and comes back to Islam, which makes it very clear that if they left Islam and survived, how are they able to come back? There's also a chapter towards the end of the Quran, say, O you who don't believe, to me is my faith and to you is yours, and it repeats it multiple times, actually. It's one of the early verses that children actually learn. So there's also a verse in the Quran that says there's no compulsion in religion. So again, cherry picking, you have 6,000 verses, you can cherry pick and say, well, this verse must mean that, this verse must mean this. How people interpret any religion, any sacred book, is really based on how tolerant, how enlightened, and what kind of people they are. So at the end of the day, more work definitely needs to be done in many of these Muslim-majority countries to reach an understanding of a pluralistic, tolerant version of Islam that I believe, and I know Jihad believes, is possible if you look at many of the verses of the Quran. And we can always look back at a magical time called Andalusia, when Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived and worked together and created a beautiful civilization. So what is Islam? 1,400 years of history. Pick a certain point. You can't really put it in a nutshell.
All right. Unfortunately, we've reached a point where we have time really for one last question, and I'm going to ask both of you to respond, first Jihad and then Amina. What's the single most disconcerting, irrational fear of Islam that you have encountered and would like to ask folks to put aside in your judgment?
So there are two. about equal. One is that Islam mistreats women and that Islam is violent. I would say that there are Muslims who mistreat women, and that's abhorrent. And Islam, when understood correctly, should uphold women and the status of women to be equal of that of men. So Islam, when understood correctly, is a feminist movement. And not just my opinion, but the opinion of scholars historically. Secondly, that Islam is a violent religion. And I would say some people invoke Islam in committing acts of violence. The number is very small, although it gets a lot of press coverage. I met with the head of the FBI who told me the percentage of Muslims around the world and here in the United States that are supportive of ISIS or groups like ISIS is infinitesimal, 0.002%.
Please.
0.002%. However, the impact is quite significant in that it gets a lot of headlines and, usually they're spectacular acts of terrorism. So we need to give it a lot of attention. But to answer your question, it's simply that, we as Muslims are at the forefront of identifying those people who are espousing an extremist ideology, and we are best equipped to help protect our country against those who want to do it harm, who identify as Muslims.
Amina, single greatest disconcerting, irrational fear of
Islam? Well, he touched the most common, terrorism and women, but what I find is that people look at Islam and look at Muslims and see them as exceptionally violent, exceptionally anti-women, exceptionally whatever the term is that is negative and you insert it. So to give an example, we don't do the same thing, and you can, look at news stories now and spin it a little bit. There was a man who walked into a school in San Bernardino recently and shot his wife because I believe she was going through divorce proceedings. If that had been a Muslim, you can imagine how that would have been spun, because it's not only an honor killing, it's also terrorism. It turned out that he was actually a Christian preacher, and yet the media did not pick up on this. And so when Muslims commit the same acts that a Christian, Jew, Buddhist, or Hindu does, the view is that they are exceptionally bad. And you can test yourself by just taking any news story and inserting a Muslim or inserting another in the place of a Muslim. And so that's what it is really challenging, the dehumanization that one feels that is specific to Islam.
All right. Thank you very much, both. I hope all of you who are here this evening enjoyed this program brought to you by my office and the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Amina Jandali and Jihad Turk, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you who are joining us on the radio and the web. And now, in keeping with the Commonwealth Club's practice, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.